Good morning, afternoon, or evening, wherever or whenever you are. This is the Lightning Podcast, where we discuss and explore the weekly meditations without necessarily reaching any conclusion. Welcome. I'm your host, Cyrus Polizbon, and I'm joined today by Nico Sarian and Zohar Atkins. Welcome, guys.
Hey.
Hey.
The quote of the week that we are covering today is by Adam Smith from Wealth of Nations, and it reads, "It is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own interest." Where is he coming from here? Sounds like the bedrock of the system we live in.
What is the best way to coordinate 8 billion people? Is it by self-interest or something else? And according to Adam Smith, self-interest is the best way to organize people. It's the most reliable way to organize people. And I think he's right. I think if you, for example, asked 10 people to figure out how to coordinate 8 billion people, there'd be many shortages. If you asked 10 people to decide what human nature is and then to predict what's going to happen as a result of human nature, they would largely get it wrong. So I think this is what economists call revealed preference. It's best to just let people reveal what their preferences are. And when you aggregate all of it, the complexity of it will add up to something that actually works. That being said, so at the time that Smith was writing, this was obviously a radical idea. Now it is the world in which we more or less live, because the assumption was that rather the good society would come from people choosing to do the good and noble thing as opposed to just pursuing their base self-interest and allowing the market to aggregate those interests to arrive at a common good. Smith's line contrasts benevolence with self-interest. And that's where I would raise a question. And Smith himself wrote multiple books. He also wrote The Theory of Moral Sentiments, in which he develops a moral theory of the self as not just self-interested, but also self that does seek to be good, to be moral. But essentially, why do we contrast benevolence with self-interest when many of us consider it in our self-interest to be benevolent for all kinds of reasons? One reason might be because we want to be well-liked. Another might be because our brand or our reputation will suffer if we're perceived not to be benevolent. A third could be that we take an expansive view of our self-interest and we want to get into heaven, or we want to wake up tomorrow with a good conscience, whatever it is. And so we need to do the benevolent thing. And I think Smith would say in response to me, that's all well and good that people can be as expansive as they want, but the market doesn't care. The market just wants to know what people value. It's up to us to decide whether our values are in line with sort of virtue or whether our values are in line with something more base. But the market is just coordinating the aggregate of all of our values, regardless of whether it agrees with whether our values are what they ought to be. If you want, like it says in the Big Lebowski, you want a toe, I can get you a toe. So the market just gets us a toe. It doesn't weigh in on whether it's good that we should want a toe. And his example of the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, and the baker is a good example, because we're talking about dinner, which is something that we need, or at least food, which we need. We don't necessarily need dinner. But I wonder if we substituted a different example from the butcher and the baker and the brewer, how the quote would land. For example, we said it is not from the roofer.
The man who does the roof.
I was thinking, because that's still a necessity. Like, what about
the artist?
It's explaining that he's just using the example as a means to point to the fundamental principle that drives exchange under his.
Yeah, but self-interest is a complicated term, basically. So I'm not a Marxist or anything, but but if I'm reading this line through the lens of Marx, in Smith would say, look, the worker from his own self-interest, the butcher, is performing the service and he's getting paid, and now he can have a good middle class petit bourgeois life. This is great. It's a win. Whereas a Marxist would look at it and say, is the butcher really choosing that? Or is the butcher just doing the best that he can under a condition of exploitation? So what?
Well,
what
but, I mean, I think there's a few nuances there that I would like to.
But I guess, but the point is, who's defining self-interest? In Smith, the self is almost autonomous and reveals its self-interest through what it chooses to do. Whereas in the Marxist tradition, you presume almost a guilt until proven innocent. You presume a false consciousness. And so what the butcher thinks is in his self-interest is not in his self-interest. It just represents what he has to tell himself every morning to get up and go do his butchery.
Unless someone says that self-interest is an inherent value to salvation or to life, because that's the background of Schmitt, is that we're talking Smith, not Marx. We're talking 18th century Scotland here, like midst of the Scottish Enlightenment and Calvinists. No, the first person who talked about the visible hand wasn't Smith; it was Calvin. No, so you rewind history 200 years back, and usury was still a sin. No, or maybe 300 years back before Luther, or well, it's actually Calvin who makes that adjustment, not Luther. So interest, like pursuing your own interest economically, is not only allowed but encouraged, let's say, for me as a means of redemption. No, this doesn't mean that Schmitt is saying this. It's that
Smith.
I'm sorry, Smith, not Schmitt. Yeah, I'm like mixing everything here. Smith, I'm not. Did I say Marx or Schmitt before?
We got you.
Yeah. No, but my point is that pursuing your own interest is a good in itself by this period. And benevolence, it's not that, I don't think it's interest versus benevolence. I think he's just arguing that, let's say, modern exchange, the way that the liquidity of it, because again, like you would say, if I can, I don't know, hunt my own deer, butcher it up and cook it myself, why do I need a butcher? I'm not relying on the butcher there. I'm relying on myself. But you're expecting dinner. You're not cooking your dinner. Within this scenario, yeah, it is driven by everybody trying to make a buck.
Yeah, he's saying it's irrespective of how the butcher feels about you. It's about how the butcher feels about you.
I think there is a little, some of that might play in, which might make it more interesting, which is I'm not selling it to these people because I don't like these people. But generally what drives a business is the pursuit of profit. That's basically, yeah, ABC Adam Smith, no?
Which you'd say is self-interest, their own interest.
Yeah.
You can also apply this quote to being like, you could say, it is not from the benevolence of your fellow drivers that you can expect not to crash, but from their own self-interest.
The guy, butcher, is going to work the whole day chopping up a cow because he likes you. I believe that it's very difficult to get someone to do that for you just because they like you, you know?
So if they do it because they like you, that's also self-interest. You're just paying them in a different currency than cash. You're paying them in the praise that you give them for their artistry or whatever.
I think you have to be pretty, I'm not being a cynic here, but you have to be very enlightened to think like
you could then apply this to everything though, if you took it from that angle.
So, I'm gonna clean the street because people are gonna like me because I'm cleaning the street, because I'm doing it. I don't think there's a lot of people that think like this.
It is not from the benevolence of the guy at the bar trying to pick me up that I expect my cocktail. But from regard to his own self-interest.
That's a good one. Very good. Very good. Did you just make that up? That's me.
It is not from the benevolence of the guy holding the door for me, like a gentleman, that I expected not to shut in my face, but rather from regard to his own self-interest. I think... Like when you take an expansive view, right? Like everything... I think that for better and for worse, Smith turns everything into a transaction. Mm-hmm. And that's the point of my example, because you can see both sides of it, right? You can certainly see the guy holding the door and say, that's not chivalry. That is a transaction. It's a very small one, but it's essentially a call option on some kind of hope for a date or whatever, even just a moment of flirtation, something. But you can also see it as, hey, maybe the guy has a certain value and this is how he wants to show up in the world. And it isn't all transactional. Like he's doing it for its own sake because it's the right thing to do. So I think
or because he likes it, you know,
or because he likes it,
enjoys what he does.
Yeah. Right. That's like almost a Kafka-esque interpretation. I don't know if you guys have ever read the story of Hunger Artist. It's one of my favorite Kafka short stories. Nico, have you read it?
No.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So allow me a little brief detour on this because I think it's actually a great story to think about the lens of Adam Smith. I had never made the connection before. So the story itself is as interesting as the way in which Kafka frames the story. It's like one of those meta stories where the narrator is telling the story from a distance. And so it begins by saying, we no longer live in a time of hunger artists. Now I'm going to tell you a story about the last hunger artist, or I'm going to tell you a story about back when hunger artists were a thing. So what actually is a hunger artist in German? It's a Hungerkünstler. It's like a made-up Kafka-esque concept that maybe has a little bit of a antecedent in reality, but it's a stretch. And it's basically a guy whose profession, his career, his livelihood, comes from starving himself for long periods of time. And it's a source of entertainment. People go and they say, wow, look at this guy. He hasn't eaten in 30 days. That's so difficult. That's so amazing. That's so profound. Wow. So this hunger artist has an impresario, basically a manager, depending on your view of the manager, is either the guy that does his business, the business side of things, or maybe it's the guy who's exploiting him, like almost like the owner of a circus versus the person in the circus. But anyways, his impresario forbids him from fasting for 40 days. The hunger artist himself wants to fast for more than 39 days. He believes he's able to, but his impresario will not allow it. And we as the reader can infer, I forget if it's mentioned explicitly or not, but we as the reader can infer the reason being that the impresario knows that people will stop being interested beyond a certain time. And so you need to clip. We have the 39 days of hunger artist, but after that, it's like, all right, moving right along. It's not going to hold our attention forever. And then, of course, 40 in the Bible is a very important number. The Jews wander for 40 years in the desert. It takes 40 days for the waters of the flood to subside for Noah to get off the ark. So 40 is like this kind of almost like divine number. So he's not allowed to achieve the divine number. He's not allowed to verge into the miraculous. He can fast for 39 days. That's believable that a human can starve for 39 days. But 40, that's too extreme. That's, what is this, religion or something?
What are you really doing?
So anyways, so I'm doing a long buildup and then we're going to have to bring it back to Smith. But basically, this guy, he starves himself for 39 days. People love it. They pay to see him. But then there's some kind of cultural or technological change and people lose interest in the hunger artist. And so the hunger artist ends up sharing a cage with all these wild animals that are kept in the zoo or kept in the show. And people are coming and they're looking at the wild animals and no one's actually paying any attention to the hunger artist. And meanwhile, this is so Kafka-esque, but the guy, because people have stopped paying attention to him, he's finally able to go beyond 39 days. And he's going for countless days. He's actually lost count of how many days he's been fasting for, but well beyond 40. He's shriveling in the back of a cage while people are like admiring some leopard or some other new feat. And as the hunger artist is reflecting on his life, he's dying of starvation. He reveals that nobody ever wanted to know why he became a hunger artist. Like nobody wants to understand like how it is that he had the motivation to not eat for such a long period of time. And the punchline of the story, which is the letdown of a punchline, is he was a picky eater. Like he just didn't like food that much. How do we relate the figure of the hunger artist and what he represents to Adam Smith? I think that Adam Smith would focus on the equilibrium between the supply of hunger artists and the demand for hunger artists and say that the fact that the hunger artist is no longer in existence, people no longer pay to see hunger artists, is a sign of the market changing its mind and going from assigning a positive price signal to a hunger artist to assigning a negative price signal. And what's interesting is that in the process of that switch, the hunger artist himself realizes actually he wasn't motivated by the money. He wasn't being a hunger artist because he wanted to make a buck. And what he really wanted to do is optimize, to put it economically, he wanted to optimize for number of days in hunger. And his impresario wouldn't allow him to go to 40, and now he can finally go to 40 because people no longer are focusing on him. So in a way, it's a kind of, he's liberated from economics, and he's allowed to return to his benevolence. Whereas when the market was focused on him, he was only allowed to fast for 39 days because it was not from benevolence that he was fasting for 39. It was from a calculation on the part of the impresario of how to best capture value from onlookers. And obviously Kafka's an artist, and perhaps there's an analogy between the hunger artist, which is an extreme case in all artistry. There's a sense of self-violence and people suffering for their art and the relationship that one has to one's audience, which is one in which you need them economically and you need them to validate you, but then you also don't need them and maybe don't want them. And maybe you're just in it because you want to fast for 40 days and you want to achieve kenosis or ascesis. And the impresario and you won't allow you to do that so long as your art is commercial. But as soon as it stops being commercial, then you can finally be free to pursue art for its own sake. So I don't know, Nico, you're going to have to help me bring this back to Smith. But
I actually, speaking of which, I just asked Adam Smith, what does he think about the hunger artist?
Can you explain to the audience what that means?
Yeah, so what Nico's talking about is we here at Lightning we're creating GPTs for all the great authors in our Alexandria library. And we've created one for Adam Smith. And yeah, Nico just
it's asked a basic fine-tuned model of Adam Smith. At least that's where it's at right now.
So go to our Adam Smith work in progress. Page in Alexandria and chat it up with Adam Smith. Great.
Yeah. Amazing.
You say, how do I get on the Alexandria page? The links are provided every day on our meditation WhatsApp group. So join it. So what'd you ask Adam Smith?
So I asked Adam Smith, what do you think of Kafka's The Hunger Artist? And although I tuned the model not to engage with any content that was after the death of Smith, it still did. It gave me a 400 word answer, which I'm going to read a paragraph. It goes, from an economic standpoint, the Hunger Artist Act can be viewed as a product he offers to the market. Initially, there is a demand for his performance, and he's able to pursue his interests within the existing societal and economic framework. However, the states and values shift, the demand for his art declines, illustrating how market dynamics are not only governed by supply and demand, but also by changing cultural norms. Preferences.
I'll tell you why I love this story so much. I could just read it every year. It's so haunting, the story, because the way that Kafka frames it, you're rooting for the hunger artist and you identify with the hunger artist and you're sad when people stop paying interest to the hunger artist. And when this guy is in the back of a cage and this leopard is taking front stage, you're like, come on, just pay attention to the hunger artist. And you get so wrapped up in it that you actually lose focus on what this guy is doing for his daily bread and for his attention, which is he's starving himself. Okay, he's torturing himself. He's doing something that in another context, you would say that is, I'm not going to be filtered here. That is sick. That is disgusting. You're talking about a person who's got an eating disorder or some kind of mental disorder, who's capitalizing on it, and society is rewarding him with praise and profit and basically leading him to his downfall. And this impresario is taking his cut and telling him, wow, you're such a good guy. You're so talented. And we're all rooting for this guy's total destruction. And so it's a beautiful tale, because you don't start with a sense of horror, in my view, at least my experience of it. You start with this guy has a trade and a talent, and now society is leaving him behind. But then when you focus on what's being left behind, it really is, you can also view it as a story of moral progress. Thank God they left that behind. Should we really be allowing people to do all kinds of self-harm in public and monetizing it? That's barbarism. Think of like ancient circuses where people would be tortured and the crowds would cheer and say, yeah, do more torture. And we still have forms of that, obviously, on the internet, and you can find anything. And if you're willing to pay, it exists. So the hunger artist is still very much there in society if you can find enough people to incentivize it. But the way that Kafka makes you feel from the hunger artist's point of view that it's sad that he can no longer be a hunger artist. That's what's compelling about the story, even though the rational part of your view is like, why should this hunger artist exist at all? It's actually quite a good thing that the hunger artists don't exist and that we've substituted, let's say, the attention economy has moved on to leopards. Maybe it's cruel for the leopard to keep it in a cage, but it seems less cruel than keeping a starving man in the cage. I think about it in the context of, sorry, don't cancel me for this, but creatives who are losing their jobs to AI. And Adam Smith would say, this is great. We're bringing the cost of production to zero. And now the consumer will, and society as a whole, will be net benefited from the fact that if we prefer the AI to the human, then so be it. That's good. But you talk to the artists and they it's a catastrophe. What does it mean for their identity that they'll no longer be able to make a living doing something that the AI can do better? Even if the AI can't do it better, society is just good enough.
Yeah.
And so then, in a sense, all artists now are hunger artists. The separate, like Kafka's tale can also be read through that lens. But then, and here's the eerie thing that I'll pose to you, Cyrus, as an actor and to listeners who have an artistic dimension to their lives and maybe livelihoods. How do we know that our art isn't the same as the hunger artist? That it is actually a form of self-harm? But society has rewarded us with attention and with praise. And so we've convinced ourselves, wow, I'm an artist. When actually we should be doing something else. And there are too many artists, too many people out there starving themselves literally and figuratively for attention when they could have just gotten a better, easier job, easier life. And maybe they could have just dabbled with a little intermittent fasting on the side, so to say.
Yeah. It's funny. I was just working out with Renee, team member of Invisible. He helps us with all kinds of tech stuff for those who are listening to the podcast. You have Renee to thank for this thing getting up. But I was at the gym with him. We're workout buddies. And I said, man, Renee, why couldn't I have wanted to be an engineer? Why couldn't I have wanted to be a doctor? And you just say these things to your, close friends. You don't really expect anything out of it. But I was having that thought. I was like, why'd I pick such a goddamn hard thing that's so intangible? I have to work to ask for work. You have to prove myself. There's very few other fields that you try so hard to be given the opportunity to work for someone else. To your question, actually, before that, I was thinking of that as you were talking about the hunger artist. That thought came up to me. I was like, oh, what's the difference? Like, this Kafka's tale seems to be like a lesson of anytime there is a change, most of the time we might perceive to be good or as progress, there's always the other side of that story. There's always another perspective to look at it. There's always a loser in history. How do we know that all artists aren't hunger artists, that we're not hurting ourselves? I don't think we do. I don't think I know. I think in a way, almost as if the hunger artist finds value in doing that, and it's his choice, then let him be the hunger artist. Maybe take the impresario out of the equation. Like, what happens when I remove the influence? Does he still think he should be a hunger artist? If we tell him, maybe you shouldn't be doing that, he's no, I love doing this. Then it's your life, man. Just like I don't go and stop someone from eating a pack of donuts. It's, you really want to eat those donuts, dude? Like, giving yourself a heart attack. But hey, you're in bliss right now. At what point do you become
that? Was another brilliant inversion in Kafka, is that you would think if it were a normal story that the hunger artist says, yeah, I don't mind fasting for 39 days, but my damn boss, he's forcing me to do it for 40 days. I'm at my limit.
Yeah.
And he just soften up, but he reverses it. And the guy, all he wants is to fast for 40 days to prove that he can do it. But the boss won't let him be excessive in his self-harm. He's only allowed to be moderate in his self-harm.
I have a question. So in the story, does the hunger artist, and this is, I'm circling back to Smith here, does he enjoy starving himself?
So I have to go back and read it closely. It's a great question.
Okay.
I think that he can't do anything else. And it is his calling, so to say. Whether he enjoys the physical activity, what does that even mean? I'm not sure you could say that his dopamine, like,
What I mean, like, I can precise what I mean by enjoyment. That what he does is has a higher degree of...
He's an artist. I think
prodigality. Like, there's no utility.
He gets a sense of pride from doing something that he's good at, and a secondary pride from the fact that people value it and see him as excellent. And he would get even more pride and even more joy if he could just show you just how excellent he is at it. But he's constrained in that regard because he's not allowed to do the 40 days.
Imagine the following. Like, I'm going to change something in the quote and see how you think about this. So it would, instead of it being from the benevolence of blah, 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 the brewer, the baker, but from the regard of their own interest, that's the Smith quote. My quote, like, what I would change, and I have a thinker in mind that thinks this way, Charles Fourier. I'll explain who it is. But it would be, it is not from the benevolence of the butcher, the brewer, or the baker that we expect our dinner, but from their regard to their own self-enjoyment, or enjoyment for that matter. This is not what we have to do. I don't know. We will have to see to what extent this would apply. But Charles Fourier, who was basically a social utopist or from early 19th century French France, thought that the best way to organize society is by the enjoyment of the function performed by each subject. For instance, he had this idea of, he had this social structure called a phalanx or phalanstère.
Yeah. You know?
And one example of a social function that would be performed in regards to enjoyment, he said something like, kids, they like to play with garbage, so they should collect the trash. So it's very interesting. But
what if you have somebody who enjoys doing something, but society doesn't value it at all?
You mean something transgressive or...
Or even just take the hunger artist. Like the hunger artist, should he get universal basic income so he can continue starving himself even after nobody wants to watch him?
He cares about himself, like, doesn't he?
Eventually,
you don't have to worry about him. He just dies.
Like, so, within a system, what function does the hunger artist perform? Entertainment. One is entertainment, and then he's less of a parasite than anybody else because he doesn't eat food. So he doesn't consume more, like, he has a low caloric intake. So he doesn't, like, it's not, I'm thinking for real here, it's not very difficult to integrate someone who doesn't eat that much because they don't need so much upkeep.
I think Smith, that's a great, I like that you brought in Fourier. I think that's a great, I think Nassim Taleb, he's a finance writer and sort of philosopher of sorts in the skeptical tradition. He has a line that stuck with me, which is something to the effect of, you should be a communist with your immediate family, a socialist with your friends, and a libertarian with strangers. It's less about the specifics of the line and more this idea that actually different social circles require different levels of intimacy and obligation. Mm-hmm. And so if we assume that we're all strangers to one another, then I think Smith really does well explain how we can coordinate and get along rather than engaging in zero-sum conflict and mutual suspicion. And it's actually just find the point in the other person that aligns with your self-interest and work together. And then the closer you are to someone, the more you want to get away from the transactional and have more of this almost like an infinite line of credit. Where,
you know, that's the way it used to work back in the hunting and gathering societies. You would only exchange with the neighboring tribe that you would actually need to exchange in order to prevent a war. It was gift exchange back then.
Yeah.
But it was like exchange had a different function. But yeah. So
I think we want self-enjoyment for ourselves and others who we're close to. But the problem is that as we get more abstracted and more atomized, we have to rely on self-interest rather than self-enjoyment to coordinate our varying tendencies and drives. I think an example of this is how people will... And each person will make their own calculus. That's really Smith's point. Your calculus is yours to make. No one can make it for you. Mm-hmm. But people will do the work that is less enjoyable for a higher price. And so the equilibrium says that even though I would rather do the more enjoyable thing, I'm willing to take the drudge work in order that I can then have enjoyment unlocked. Presumably from a better paycheck or something like this.
So let me try to establish a formula here, because to go back to Cyrus, what Cyrus was saying of why didn't I pick a more, why didn't I become an engineer, a doctor, a more, I don't know,
tangible.
Yeah, something that pays better, right? And what you were saying, Zohar, about jobs that are not enjoyable, and this certainly does not apply today because like a garbage man, like who likes picking up trash? I don't know how much they get paid, but it, like in an ideal world, I think the formula would be something like there should be like the less enjoyment or the less enjoyable the job, the higher the demand for that should be. I don't know how this would work today, but for instance, I don't know
I see it as a 2x2. So you have things which are, where you really want to be is you want to be in the quadrant of things that are both enjoyable for you to do.
Yeah.
And presumably for anyone to do.
Yeah.
Also highly demanded.
Yeah.
And maybe if everybody enjoys doing them, then everyone will be motivated to do them. And then that will drive down the price, thus making the demand decrease. Mm-hmm. Right. So then on the other end of the spectrum, you have things which are not enjoyable and which are not desired. For example,
you mean not in high demand.
Not in high demand and not enjoyable. For example, being the person who disposes of bodies in the morgue. I would imagine that is a non-enjoyable job. I also don't think there are that many positions open. The total addressable market is limited by the number of deaths that take place in hospitals.
Yeah.
Just to be super morbid, literally. So I don't agree with the utopian view, though, that just because it's non-enjoyable, that there should be a compensation. I think there'll be some compensation for it, like that job compared to another job that's more enjoyable. But also equally in low demand.
No, but I get your point. But what I mean is that if something is not enjoyable, then less people will do it. But you still need people to do the job, so you'll have a reduced supply of labor, for which the demand might stay the same, but the price increases because of that. I'm not an economist, but
like saying we don't have enough. We don't have enough doctors because it's such a rigorous process to go through.
For instance, I'll take Argentina as an example. There used to be few engineers, no? But they need engineers. So the demand for engineers is high, the supply is low. They are the ones who get paid the most. Now it's different, but else in mind, which is today everybody uses a computer and works on a computer. But 40 years ago, a person who would work on a computer was a job of being the computer guy, right? It's maybe most people did not like using a computer, so they were not the computer guy. You're a nerd or whatever. But now everybody.
Yeah, the reason it wasn't enjoyable was because it was new, though. So the thing that's not enjoyable is learning a new skill. Like going through the fear, uncertainty, and doubt that comes from having to change your habit and change your mindset, not the actual computer stuff itself. I don't think the skill set is the thing that caused the lack of joy. I could be wrong.
It's the fact of being in front of a screen the whole day, I think.
It's also the lack of legibility of what do you do. So this has to do with the psychology, but people like to do things that you can tell other people, I do this, and they nod their heads like, oh, yeah, sure. And they will take a pay cut for the status gain that comes from just having something that's legible, socially legible. And maybe they correlate the sense of being socially legible with some sense of stability as well. Even though, and this is another point Taleb makes, like an Uber driver whose weekly salary is lumpy, meaning some weeks they get a lot of rides, the next week they get fewer rides, and so it's harder for them to predict what is their monthly salary because it can vary by an order of magnitude. But that person appears to be unstable, whereas the banker who shows up at the same investment banker shows up at the same place every day for work, gets a specific salary that they know what it is. But then comes a financial crisis and the bank explodes. The person's out of a job, not going to get another job in banking for a bunch of years. That person's in a worse position psychologically, not necessarily financially, but probably also financially, than the Uber driver, because the Uber driver has been practicing robustness.
Right.
Whereas the other person in Taleb's framing is fragile. So you need to evaluate something, not just in terms of its present state, whether it happens to be up or down, but also in terms of how it will fare in a downside scenario.
I think, was it Taleb who said that let's say, Lebanese people, for instance, or that, was it him?
Yes, he's Lebanese.
So
he grew up during the civil war in Lebanon and had to flee. Mm-hmm. Some of his family members were killed in the civil war. And so he basically says that experience was formative for him because he realized that the shocking event, the downside scenario, is more likely than the average mind appreciates. And so the question is, in terms of investing concepts, you don't want the best possible return. Sorry, you don't want the best realized return. Mm-hmm. What you want is the best risk-adjusted realized return. And Taleb's point is that many people think the returns are really good because they look at the realized returns, but they don't realize how much risk they're actually taking on in order to get those realized returns. And when you adjust for the risk, you would rather have less realized returns,
right,
and be more subject to resilience in the case of the shock. And that's where he comes to a certain fondness for the Uber driver, and the Uber driver is like a parable for a whole way of being in the world.
Unless we get self-driving cars, right? Or that doesn't even apply to the...
No, it applies, but the concept, the point is psychologically. He's not talking about whether the job is secure.
Yeah.
The Uber driver is also at risk in terms of his job. He's talking about the mindset of the Uber driver who expects lumpy revenue.
Freelance.
And because of that, doesn't get disoriented or put down when he loses his job. Whereas the person who every day shows up to the same job for 10 years and then loses it is psychologically disadvantaged by
that. Yeah,
it can be devastated. And he compares this person to, and this is why he's critical of statistics, which is always fun, he compares it to the turkey for the 100 days before Thanksgiving, and the turkey's got a graph of how well he's doing, and every day
alive
and he's eating and everything's good, and then just right, and then the graph on Thanksgiving and he's just goes straight to zero. And this is his metaphor. Is like statisticians, they point to the graph like, what a lovely graph. But it's like, it's irrelevant that it's been doing well for 100 days because what matters is, or sorry, 99 days, because what matters is the 100th day. And that's it's not even a possibility for them. So he's not saying that you can predict when the 100th day is. He's just saying have the humility to appreciate that there's probably a 100th day in the system that you're not aware of. And you want to hedge for that, not just maximize the number of days that you're alive.
We're going to die anyway.
So how do we get to Taleb, though, from Smith?
I reeled us back to Smith and offered this comparison to this idea I get from Charles Fourier of comparing the driving principle of the economy being self-interest versus self-enjoyment. And that brought you to Taleb.
Okay, great. So I think I can square the circle. I'll give it a crack.
Yeah.
So Taleb says we live in two worlds. We live in the world of Mediocristan and we live in the world of Extremistan. Is the world in which statistics applies. And if you just go by the average, you'll be able to predict relatively well what's going to happen tomorrow and the day after. And everything follows a bell curve pattern and it's all very lovely and symmetrical. And Extremistan is the world of outliers where an event can happen and it will produce a 1,000x or 10,000x change in outcome, either for the upside or for the downside. The reason I can rely upon the self-interest of the butcher, the brewer, and the baker is because I live in Mediocristan. And in Mediocristan, I know that these people are reliable because they need their paychecks to go and support their lifestyle and their needs. And we're all networked together and everything runs on this presumption that we're all rational and transparent to one another. And that works 99% of the time. But what happens in an extreme scenario, in an extreme negative scenario? Can I then rely upon them? I may not be able to. What happens in an extremely positive scenario? I also might not be able to rely upon them. And this is an interesting question or topic in the context of companies and scaling, where basically, if you're a startup, you want the 10,000x. Take Lightning, for example. We want to get to 1 million users. So a lot of extreme things need to happen. A lot of nonlinear things need to happen for that to be true. If we just follow the self-interest of the butcher, the brewer, and the baker, that's not going to happen. So we actually need to appeal to something beyond the self-interest, I think, which is, I wouldn't call it irrational, but like the missionary aspect of the butcher, the brewer, and the baker, the part of the heroic aspect of these characters. We need to like almost like tap into the soul of the butcher and the brewer and the baker. And if we can activate that, then we can achieve this 10,000x return. But if we're just like, hey, this is a rational thing, that incrementalism isn't going to achieve anything. At the same time, once you achieve a certain level of scale, then you need reliable, you need mediocristan. You don't want to be living the world of where tomorrow could bring a 10,000x positive return or a 10,000x negative return. What you want is to go from convexity, I guess that's the word in Ptolemyan terms, convexity, like the referring to the how curved the graph is, to linearity. If I have a team of, we're a team of three full-timers and three part-timers now.
Right.
So we want every week to be an order of magnitude change from the previous week. But when we have 1,000 people working for us, maybe we don't want so much entrepreneurial energy. We want a little bit of it. But what we want is to make sure that people are keeping to their linear path that we've decided makes the most strategic sense. And if everybody's like pursuing convexity, the thing is going to crash. It's going to be too complicated. So it's almost like you have to find, and I think, and this all works with Smith. It doesn't contradict Smith at all. But basically, like, we have in the world different levels of risk tolerance. And there's a presumption in investing that while taking on more risk doesn't guarantee a better outcome, people do take on more risk in the hopes that they will get a better outcome. In other words, the only way to justify the risk I'm taking is to be compensated with the possibility of a better outcome. Why are there so many starving artists? Because each of them hopes that they'll be the one that ends up like Tom Cruise or Scarlett Johansson. And so they're willing to take the risk of being, this is the economic view, of being the waiter forever in the hopes that they win the lottery. Whereas if you're playing the engineer game, or the doctor game, then you don't need to be one in 10,000 because it isn't winner take all. There's room for lots of doctors and lots of engineers. There's only room for so many celebrity A-list actors. And so I think Smith would say the market in its wisdom and its aggregation of individual self-interest distributes risk tolerance such that some people pursue the more risky path that's also higher reward, and other people pursue the more average path in expectation of a more average yet predictable reward. And that if there's an inefficiency in the market and it's too lopsided towards the one or the other, then it will sort itself out over time. And I think this is the key point, is that Smith basically is an antecedent of what's called the efficient market hypothesis, which is the idea that the market is always right in any given time. It's perfectly coordinating the intelligence on the supply side with the intelligence on the on the demand side. And I think the counter argument to that is that no, the market is always inefficient, and that inefficiency is an opportunity for somebody to develop their edge and beat the market. And Cyrus, to take an example, projecting here, but you can tell me if it checks out, maybe realizes that the acting market is oversaturated. So trying to win that tournament is not a good risk reward equation. Whereas being an actor who's the head of publishing at Lightning, there aren't very many actors doing that. And so even though Lightning could fail, and so he's now got to accept that entrepreneurial risk, if it succeeds, then there's now all of a sudden a new category that opens up to someone who in a different context would just be playing the tournament.
Right. Exactly. 0-1. Yeah. But I have one critique, though, to like the... To your reading of Smith there, because using Cyrus as an example as an actor, okay. And I guess this is not Cyrus, but like acting or just artists in general. And I guess this could also be seen as a form of efficiency within the labor market, which is, to put it in a very funny way, you start as an actor or as a painter or as a musician or whatever, and you graduate as a real estate agent.
That's what usually happens. That's what usually happens.
Yeah.
Yeah. By the time someone hits 23, 25, they switch.
Yeah. But is there something in the pursual of the risk involved in the realty or in the fact that you become a real estate agent? You would have never considered becoming a real estate agent from the get-go. It's only a career you like default to if plan A doesn't work, no?
Actually, a lot of you go in Los Angeles and you talk, if you go to Los Angeles and you talk to industry professionals, film industry professionals, people do lighting or production design or casting, whatever, like the whole shebang other than acting, a lot of them came to be actors or writers. And then they discovered through the jobs that they had to take to survive that, oh, actually, you know what? I'm perfectly happy doing this. This is actually something, maybe it's a combination of something that's feasible and also passive. Maybe they still would like to be an actor, but they've discovered that this is sufficient for them also and pays, and then they go off. But yeah, that happens. I think the whole industry is full of people who came from one thing and then graduated to another.
How is that a critique of me or of Smith though?
No, the point being that efficiency is not something that is clear cut within the market, and that's what I mean. It's yes, being an artist, it's like you get, again, you need risk aversion
I think it is clear cut, meaning it's not legible, but it's revealed. Young people take the risk because they can. And by a certain age, many of them stop taking the risk because they've now calculated that in their self-interest, they want to be more risk-averse. So in both cases, it's rational. Though, let's say an 18-year-old wants to maximize for their convexity potential, but that a 35-year-old wants to maximize for more stability. So I think the fact that the actor becomes a real estate agent proves the equilibrium principle in Smith.
Right. But my point is, what happens? Where is the efficiency in the years that preceded the switch?
The efficiency is basically them discovering whether or not they have a chance at making it, and then their call option on making it expires. And when it expires, then the value of the option goes down, and so they then switch.
So you would say that like they had to experience the life of an artist for, I don't know, 5 to 10 years to realize that they don't want to become an art, that they don't want to pursue that career, no? And that's the efficiency involved in that labor, in that preceding labor to that point, no?
If I buy the right to buy something at a future date, that right to buy it at a future date has an expiration. The longer, the farther away the expiration date, the more I need to pay now for that option. Conversely, the moment that the closer that expiration date, the less I need to pay. Because the idea is that the more duration you have, the more opportunity you have to hit your strike price.
Yeah, a call or a boot, right? Yeah, I get that.
So some people try to spend their entire life getting in the money. And other people give themselves 5 years, and if they don't make it, they don't make it. But it was still a good 5 years spent, and it was a good risk return calculation, according to Smith, by definition. Unless they're an idiot, or there's insider trading or market manipulation going on, and they're getting a bad deal. And that could be an argument that we can make is, hey, they think their odds are 1 in 10, but actually their odds are 1 in 100, and society is giving them misinformation.
Right.
So you can make that argument.
Yeah. Is Taleb the person who says that we're espousing people, let's say, success stories like Elon Musk, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, but those are exceptions? Oh, and I'm sorry.
I don't really see what's innovative in that point, meaning obviously they're exceptions, they're outliers. But
yeah.
But nobody's saying, hey, you can be Mark Zuckerberg. I don't think that's the case. I think that also, in Silicon Valley, you don't have to be Mark Zuckerberg to have a success. However, so Taleb is not making this point, but I do think like you could argue that the metrics that people use to measure success are bad metrics. And that's where people are deceived. For example, all you read are the headlines about a company that sold for X number of millions of dollars. What you really want to know is what percentage of the company does the founder own? How much dilution do they have to take? And so the enterprise value of is not actually that interesting. What's much more interesting is percent of ownership. If a person owns 100% of a company valued at 100 million versus a person who owns 2% of a company at a billion, the former is in a better shape. So we don't celebrate, oh, wow, you didn't dilute. We celebrate Goldman Sachs paid $1 billion for the company, even though in exchange, Goldman Sachs now owns the company and you don't. That is an example, though, where one man's misinformation is another man's, what's the word, expanded view of self-interest. So, for example, a person who sells out for prestige, are they being deceived because they've done a bad deal? And they're giving away real value for fake value, for superficial value. Okay, for example, you paid $60,000 a year to get a Harvard degree. So is that a go? Whatever, 80,000, I don't know. Yeah. So I haven't looked in 10 years at the price tag. So you could say that's what percentage when they're paying that is for the education. What percentage of that is for the network and the experience? Yeah. And what percentage is just to be able to say you went to Harvard? Now, I'm just make up some numbers, but let's say it's like you spent a third of that on the education, a third of it on like your peers and the network, the alumni network, and a third on the brand, like just literally being able to say, I went to Harvard on my resume. Did you overpay for the part that's just pure prestige? And some people would say in certain contexts, it really does help you get a job or get into grad school or whatever, but it still doesn't answer the question of are you overpaying or not? And in other contexts, it really doesn't matter, in which case you are overpaying. This is where Smith would say, it doesn't matter whether you're right or wrong. What matters is you're just pursuing your self-interest as you understand it. And if the fact that you were willing to pay means it wasn't your self-interest, but I think that a skeptical view on it would be that if you knew more, you had a different perspective, then you wouldn't do the deal. And so you're not acting in your self-interest, you're acting in your perceived self-interest. And people are not actually good evaluators of their self-interest. That's the nanny state argument for big government telling you what's best for you, because they don't trust you to figure it out for yourself. And then there's an argument, which we didn't even get into, which I think, Nico, you will be the most interested in, which is, again, what is the self in self-interest? So we've been focusing a little bit more on the what is the interest in self-interest. But would you do business with a crazy person? Like, I personally would not. And I don't mean... ADD, okay? Like, you know, I say crazy. Okay. We're talking about an extreme case. Yeah, you don't know. But the point is, a person who is unreliable...
Let's say someone who's a drug lord or something like this, would you do business with him?
I wouldn't do business with a butcher who today sells me meat because he's a butcher, but tomorrow tells me that he's not a butcher because he doesn't feel like being a butcher. He doesn't identify as a butcher anymore. He identifies as a baker. The point is, embedded in all of these things is a certain sense that tomorrow will be like today. And for a lot of people, you can presume that tomorrow will be like today because they have an interest in that, in maintaining the charade that tomorrow will be like today. But a crazy person doesn't abide by those rules, doesn't know how to abide by those rules. And so the incentive to participate in the theater that is reliable just isn't there for them. So Charlie Munger says, show me the incentives and I'll show you the outcomes. That works for somebody who's normal and can be incentivized. It doesn't work for somebody who is an outlier and cannot be incentivized because they're not transparent to themselves, because they're a volatile kind of person, or a missionary whose incentive scheme is so beyond your own that you wouldn't even know how to motivate them if you tried.
Steve Jobs would be a missionary or an outlier, right?
Yeah, but he's still responsive to incentives.
Yeah.
But yeah, I think an example would be like a genuine terrorist, like an ideological terrorist.
Yeah, zealot of some kind.
Would you be able to bribe them not to do terror? It might be hard. It might be hard to do that. The only way they would take the bribe is if they said, to do an expected value calculation with your $1 billion of ransom. Now I can do 10x more terror tomorrow. So that's where Smith might be helpful. It's like that even this person who doesn't operate in your moral system still has some aspect of rational calculus where they're trying to optimize. Okay, they're trying to optimize for something you're not trying to optimize for, but the optimization function is universal. See what I mean?
Yeah. Guys, yeah. We've run out of time.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
No apology necessary at all. What a fantastic episode. Ladies and gentlemen listening, if you enjoyed the conversation, you can continue this conversation if you'd like. You could join the Chronicles group chat. Maybe you're already a member and you're listening. You can just type in your, hey, following up from the Lightning podcast discussion. Up, type it in. What was the last thought? And there's no reason the conversation couldn't continue in there, but you could have plenty of others on your own. And there are conversations going on right now as we speak. So check out the links in the description. Thank you, Zohar. Thank you, Nico.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining today. Bye.